罗斯切断波兰和保加利亚天然气供应，报复两国支持乌克兰。联合国人权高专访华前夕，记者无国界组织促北京释放百余在押记者。专家分析王沪宁如何稳坐中国最高智囊位置。各位观众大家好，我是卡拉，欢迎收看美国观察。俄罗斯切断了波兰和保加利亚的天然气供应，报复两国支持乌克兰。今天的节目中我们一同关注。俄罗斯星期三在亲乌战争中另辟战场，切断了对两个坚定支持乌克兰的欧盟国家波兰和保加利亚的天然气供应。此举被视为莫斯科围绕乌克兰冲突将与西方的对抗戏剧性升级的一个重要步骤。美国国防部长奥斯汀在德国拉姆施泰因空军基地召集40多国国防官员开会，讨论如何进一步增加对乌克兰的军援，协助乌克兰军民更有效地抗击俄军对乌克兰的侵略。一天之后，克里姆林宫便把欧洲依赖程度很高的能源出口作为武器，迅速宣布对两个欧盟国家断供天然气的决定。莫斯科天然气断供的决定还是给拥有27个成员国的欧盟带来巨大的震撼。欧盟委员会主席冯德莱恩发表书面声明，指出莫斯科此举是不公正和不可接受的。欧盟的天然气供应协调机制也立即举行会议，努力将莫斯科断供的决定和的冲击和影响降至最低。记者无国界组织周三致函联合国人权事务高级专员米歇尔·巴切莱特，敦促他在五月访华期间关注中国压制新闻自由的问题。巴切莱特这次访华是为了了解新疆维族穆斯林群体遭受迫害的真实情况。联合国人权事务办公室与中国方面就此次访问进行了长期的沟通。记者无国界组织秘书长克里斯托夫·德洛瓦表示，最近几年，习近平在中国强行建立了一个基于信息控制和公民监视的社会模式，同时鼓吹建立一种使新闻工作者沦为国家宣传工具的新的世界媒体秩序。德洛瓦强调，信息自由是保护其他人权的基石，应当成为巴切莱特这次等待已久的使命的优先议题。记者无国界组织提出，释放所有124名被中国当局关押的新闻记者和新闻自由捍卫者，停止媒体审查和媒体监视等五项要求。台湾国防部星期三表示，受到目前俄乌战争的启示，将于五月举行的台湾汉光38号演习由以往的电脑兵棋推演改为图上兵棋推演，以便加强参演指挥官面对面的互动与交流。台湾国防部宣布，汉光38号大规模军演图上兵棋推演将于5月16日至20日举行，实兵演习于7月25日至29日举行。路透社在报道中指出，台湾国防部在今年的汉光演习中还将根据俄乌战争的启示，聚焦不对称战法、认知作战以及后备役部队的使用。路透社引述台湾国防部长邱国正的话说，台湾密切关注俄乌战争的经验和教训，而且就这些议题与美国保持沟通。作为台湾最重要的支持者和最大的武器供应国，美国也在密切关注俄乌战争可能对台湾防备北京的入侵提供什么样的启示。在中共中央政治局常委中排名第5的王沪宁，历经了江泽民、胡锦涛、习近平三任领导人风格不一的时期，依旧稳坐中共最高智囊的位置。他的屹立不摇有什么秘密？研究中共和王沪宁的专家马修·约翰逊表示，王沪宁80年代末来美交流半年的经验，对他日后的国际观影响深远。
王沪宁 has served as an important role under 江泽民、胡锦涛 and now 习近平。Not everyone could survive 3 very different dynasties. His career somehow seems smooth in the CCP. Were there any specific reasons behind his longevity? Something special in his personality or his temperament?
He seems to be very good at what he does, which again is, you know, sort of taking the issues that the party faces, you know, post Mao, Let's start with post Mao and even post Deng, and translating these into frameworks that make sense for the leadership and also in theory, you know, make sense outside of the party itself. So he plays a role in shaping how the party represents itself. So I think he's had a special kind of talent for, you know, fusing ideas of the party with ideas of China as a nation. But what he's done in a sense is he's updated the party's Leninist ideology for generation, so to speak. And I think this comes from a very unique part of his background. Huang, when he was an intellectual, even before he had, you know, risen to the position that he's risen to, described himself as a reader. And in particular, he was a reader of foreign intellectual and political thought. And so therefore, he had insights, I think, that for the time in which he was forming, I think, his big ideas about culture, cultural sovereignty, cultural security, et cetera. He had a fairly unique perspective on the world of foreign ideas and trends in that area. I think that made him very valuable.
Huning was the visiting scholar in the U.S. in 1988, and he later wrote America Against America based on his own observation. How would you evaluate that book?
Right, so there's a fascinating history there. Of course, you know, that book has, among some circles, become very popular once again. It seems to be popular for two reasons. One is there's an almost prescient diagnosis of the kind of issues that seem to affect the United States today. Now, I think it's only prescient if you forget that during the time that Huang was writing, all of these issues were being widely discussed in the United States as well, you know. And so what Huang's book does, though, now for a contemporary audience, and let's start with what's in Huang's book. You know, he visited the United States. He traveled to multiple cities. You know, he looked at social relations. He looked at, you know, sort of what everyday civic life, cultural life, social life looked like. He was very interested in, you know, values and ideas, you know, what got people excited, and also in the dysfunctions that he saw around him of American society. And so he put all of this into this book, America Against America. In the process, he also, you know, found a lot about the United States to admire. And, you know, this is coming from his era also. He was very struck by the power of open information and communication. He was struck by everyday details that we wouldn't see as significant now, like community libraries where, you know, anyone could wander in and borrow a book. This, obviously, coming out of China in the 1980s would have been a very, you know, novel kind of thing, where libraries were mainly for scholars and very closed. He had that kind of that early information age enthusiasm about all of the connection that he saw going on around him, basically, in the United States, and all the information that was moving around. At the end of the day, though, he decides that what he doesn't like at all about the United States is that there's no strong center, and there's too much fragmentation among the various identities, you know. And so his conclusion, which is somewhat of a heresy, is that Japan is a much more interesting country in terms of the model, you know, that Huang ultimately was interested in proposing in that book. And it's because, you know, he saw Japan as combining cultural homogeneity and a strong sense of nation-state identity with the economic dynamism and, you know, strong civic ethos that he saw in the United States, even though I think what he saw in the United States was also signs of decline, you know, that people didn't have as much of a national identity as they had sort of like subnational identities. And there was quite a lot he saw that shocked and alarmed him as well, you know, the difference in cultural values and, you know, around issues like drugs and sex and individual freedom, you know, those were in a sense shocking to him.
So his viewpoints on America and the democracy here make sense. And does it apply to the society 30 years after? How about China's self-claimed democracy?
So what Huang means by democracy, which he does mention at various points in his writings, is, you could argue, really fundamentally in tension with his more authoritarian leanings as well. But ultimately, I think what Wang means by democracy is this idea that all of the members of society should be mobilized to participate in politics. That doesn't necessarily mean that they should participate freely or that they should, you know, move according to their own goals and agendas. So it's more a sense of wanting the political community to be activated in some sense that I think you could argue is what Wang really means by democracy. So I think we do have to make some distinction here between how democracy is talked about in the traditions of Chinese Communist Party politics, which is the tradition that Wang comes from, versus the way that it's discussed, say, in a liberal democracy like the United States or Japan or elsewhere.
In late 1980s, Wang Huning helped devise the theory of neo-authoritarianism, stating China needed a heavy-handed state of guide market reforms, arguing for a necessary concentration of central authority to carry reforms out. How accurate was his observation, and how was the result of China carrying it out?
China was at a moment, you know, we're talking about the Deng Xiaoping era and immediately afterward, where the party was trying to master tensions that were very rapidly emerging between economic growth and political control. And so the question was, how does a country like Singapore, you know, manage those competing tensions in a way that is useful for, or competing objectives in a way that's useful for China's leaders to think about as well? And there is, you know, lots of anecdotal evidence that Deng Xiaoping even was, you know, somewhat influenced by this neo-authoritarian trend, right? And so that really, I think, is what Wang's neo-authoritarian moment, so to speak, and it was one that he shared with other intellectuals, is really about, you know, how to, in a sense, open the political system. So, you know, it's part of the reform and opening moment, or sorry, open the system, broadly speaking, which is to open the to open the political economy, but not to lose political control in a way that is that was identified as being, you know, a kind of trigger for just a loss of control generally. So, you know, it's how to have an orderly economic modernization, but it's not only that, it's how to have an economic modernization under a single party system of rule. And I think that was the main debate. And Wang obviously was a key part of it. You could argue now that, you know, by the standards of the present, that debate has already been eclipsed by the answer, which is that if anything, the state is going to get down into the economy in a much more forceful and active way. You know, that's the kind of Xiist moment that we're in right now.
Any negative impacts those market reforms brought to the West? And was the West misled by some of the nice work China said back then?
Well, you know, we're talking about whole decades of history and very smart people on both sides. And, you know, at the same time, interests, I think common interests on both sides of increasing China's prosperity, increasing, you know, the prosperity of the firms and banks and others that were involved in this process of globalization, enriching, in China's case, a political elite that was sort of riding on this wave of opening to create its own economic power. And so I don't know that we can argue necessarily that people were misled so much as they were maybe, you know, biased towards seeing these changes from a certain perspective because of how the interests lined up. At the same time, if there was one point that I think still, even now, is maybe not emphasized enough, it is that the Chinese Communist Party is still a Leninist institution with its own long history of organization and tactics, so to speak, for engaging with you know, audiences outside of the party. And to this day, there is an external messaging system that creates messages for the benefit of external audiences. And there's an internal messaging system that creates messages for the benefit of, you know, insiders. And so I think that the lesson there is that when looking at China generally, one always has to be focused on both at the same time. It's important to understand how external communication is being crafted and what its intended effects are, you know, which is a kind of classic propaganda question, and also be focused on the fact that there may be very different signals inside of the, you know, that are coming from inside of the political system and that are intended for a very different audience. And so whether one is misled or not, you've at least got to arbitrage in some way the difference that exists between those signals, those different modes of communication.
How was Wang Huning infused the core of Marxism into the slogans he devised? And we know that he, however, believes in relativism in politics instead of absolutism. Any ambivalence in between, since Marxism seems to be the only truth for him? And does that, like denying universal values from the West, create legitimacy for the CCP?
Wang is arguably more of a Maoist than he is a Marxist. And what I mean by this is that Wang's focus on the role and importance of culture and his belief that if one can change belief systems, then one can ultimately change history is much more consistent with Mao, say, during the era of the Great Leap Forward or during the era of the Cultural Revolution, than it is with Marx, for whom ideology was much more of an effect of, you know, deeper structural changes in the mode of production for society as a whole. So Wang's almost postmodern emphasis on ideas and, you know, the kind of functional role that ideas play in political systems is actually, you know, more of a kind of Leninist, Maoist, again, very, very kind of 1990s viewpoint, in the sense that the role of political culture and how it can be used to unify, how it can be used to mobilize, how it can be used to reinforce a sense of national community, if it's just like applied forcefully enough, that is how I would, in broad strokes, characterize Wang's thinking, and actually, you know, some of the differences that lie there between his thinking and Marxism. On the other hand, you know, he is an intellectual of the party. So his role, so to speak, is to think on behalf of the party and to think on behalf of the country. And so he's positioned that way. But that doesn't necessarily make him a Marxist. It makes him sort of something more of, like, again, a party intellectual, and now at a very, very high level.
The CCP is going to host its 28th Party Congress later this year. Any doubts for Xi Jinping getting his third term? Will it become a bigger threat to the world's peace and prosperity if he does get the third term? And any chance that China might go backwards to the Mao era, as some analysts worry?
Well, I think there's almost, I mean, speaking of universal, I think there's almost universal consensus at this point that Xi will not step down at the 20th Party Congress, or maybe even, you know, for the remainder of his natural life or his ability to remain in power. There's no historical precedent that I can think of in which a leader in his position naturally, you know, decides to hand over the reins to someone else. I mean, Mao held on to power right down to the very bitter end, you know, when he could barely speak or get out of bed. We're starting to see a resurgence of that kind of one-man rule around the world. And I think that that is pretty concerning, because it's these same regimes that are committing the worst abuses against their own people and, you know, are, in a sense, beginning to form quasi-alliances, like between China and Russia to, you know, well, if we're not going to be part of the international community, so to speak, you know, we're going to begin inflicting costs on that community, which I think is really a troubling trend. What it means for the rest of the world, I have a hard time avoiding the conclusion that in this present moment in which, you know, Xi has all but declared his unequivocal, you know, his let's put it this way, his no limits support for Russia, which is, you know, a country now engaged in the violation of all kinds of international norms around conflict and is involved in some terrible war atrocities. You know, that is not necessarily pointing in a more peaceful direction for Chinese foreign policy. And to be honest, it's not necessarily pointing in a very optimistic direction for people living in China today, because if Xi is committed to a more agonistic relationship with the West, like Russia, then there are a lot of things that follow, you know, a more aggressive posture toward Taiwan, toward India, toward other players in the Asia Pacific, you know, more focus on policies that can support the effort to rapidly militarize China's society and, you know, create a country that's capable of engaging in and winning more conflicts in the future. And, you know, this is, I think, something that could have a real impact even in 5 years' time. We already see, from an economic perspective, from a kind of policy planning perspective, a real emphasis on militarization, on closing that gap, on innovation and technology all being pushed toward, you know, so-called dual-use areas. So there are a lot of indicators here that point toward a kind of buildup, you know, in the nuclear area, in missiles as well. And that's not a policy orientation that would change just because the 20th Party Congress happens. In fact, it may be reinforced by the 20th Party Congress, although, you know, typically real policy is made after the Congresses. But, you know, I think there's a lot to be focused on there. Let's put it that way. And a lot to be wary of as well for the rest of the world.
欢迎继续收看美国观察。特斯拉首席执行官马斯克收购推特，他建议放松推特的内容限制，可能包括解除限制前总统特朗普账户的规定。在首都华盛顿，有人表示欢迎另一种声音，也有人表达了他们对假新闻和仇恨言论传播的担忧，并关切世界首富可能会为个人目的而控制内容。
So congratulations to the design team. You've done a phenomenal job. I've enjoyed working with you every week. You guys are amazing.
It's not a good day.
Several owners anymore, so that kind of gives him all the power over it. And I guess my thoughts are that things will probably get worse on Twitter if he's trying to open up freedom of speech, just because that allows room for fake news to spread, hate speech, stuff like that to happen, maybe more harassment. So I don't think it could, I guess good things could come out of it, but I see the result being more negative.
You know, for him to purchase it, that's his freedom to do that in the kind of society in which we live.
However,
do have concerns about,
yes,
what presumably he would do in terms of relative to the
misinformation,
removing filters that would screen out misinformation.
And his ability owning so much of it to control that content for his own purposes.
Exactly.
Rather than the benefit of the common good. We have a mental health crisis in our country, and for the sake of our mental health, I think some people should not be allowed on Twitter because of their use of language. You know, and no, I don't think Donald Trump should be allowed back on Twitter.
I think it's good that we have such platforms in which you can speak freely, but in democratic societies, freedom has bounds, has boundaries, and I'm not sure if Elon Musk is the one who should define these boundaries for such a huge platform like Twitter. The incidents with President Trump, I think, showed that these platforms have much, much influence on our public debate. So I think it's not so good if this is in hand of one human being. And I think Mr. Musk is also one human being who is driven by, of course, his financial interests and not driven by the public interest.
Why it's exciting news? Because of freedom of speech is at the foundation of our country, of this country.
And I think that thanks to Elon Musk, we could have more freedom of speech.
Well, it's another voice. I think that voice has been suppressed, and I am... I think we need to hear all voices.
一种检查健康人癌症迹象的新型血液测试已经上市。美国政府研究人员正在计划进行一项大型实验，研究血液检测是否能够更早地发现癌症并挽救生命。
How did I feel when knowing the cancer was gone? Jubilant?
The NCI is actively planning a large randomized control trial. We released the request for information to explore what companies that make these multi-cancer early detection assays would be willing to collaborate and participate with us and have their assays formally evaluated. In addition, once we get to the point where this trial is up and running, we'll need many Americans to sign up and participate in whatever studies we get off the ground.
And if we can find these cancers at earlier stages, before people have symptoms, they're offered many more options for effective treatment, and they're often curable.
But there is no perfect lab test. And we don't even know how close to perfect or good this test is. The evidence we have in hand does not show any health outcomes yet, so it's impossible to know whether the benefits outweigh the unavoidable harms.
以上就是今天美国观察的全部内容，感谢您的收看，我们明天再见。